yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to start out talking about U.S. GDP, gross domestic product, for the first quarter, 2018. Just came out today. Showed the U.S. economy growing at 2.3% annual rate. Okay, that's down significantly from the 3%, 2.93% in the fourth quarter of last year. So we got a slowdown in growth going on. Will that slowdown continue, or will we believe the hype and the spin that, oh, it's going to rise, actually? We'll talk about missed forecasts about rising. The Atlanta Federal Reserve, District Bank, which has a model that forecasts GDP, in February forecasted a 5.4% increase in GDP this quarter. Well, comes in at 2.3%. Well, so much for their models. And we'll see that most of these forecasts, whether U.S.-based or global, IMF, World Bank, OECD, etc., always grossly overestimate their forecasts, historically, especially the IMF and others. We'll get to that, the global picture, but first back to the U.S. trend here. So 2.3%, and remember, you always have to deduct at least 0.3% from these figures for GDP because of the revisions that were implemented a few years ago by the U.S. Commerce Department, Bureau of Economic Affairs, whatever. They're the ones that do the GDP, right? The figures added a lot of phony stuff to GDP, intellectual property, and so forth, that you can't really price accurately. They just threw it in there, and it boosted all our GDP numbers by 0.3%, about $500 billion a year, and they made it all retroactive. So when you go and look up these figures, they're all boosted by this definitional change that occurred, right? And take a look at that. When you look at GDP numbers for the U.S., looking into the past quarterly or annually. So 2.3% is really about 2%, which is, barely above the long-term average of about 1.7, 1.8% annual growth rate, which was the average since the 2008-09 crash. The economy has been growing at about 60% of what it had been growing on average historically long-term before 2008. So it's kind of ratcheted into a lower growth mode. And last year, of course, 2017, particularly in the last half, was an aberration to that, as businesses expected a big tax cut windfall, which they got in December, and they started spending on inventories and some equipment replacement because now they can write it all off. You can write off all your equipment in the first year, most businesses. And so, that's a big windfall. Cost-cutting at the expense of the taxpayer, of course. The businesses can write off everything. Well, when you can write off everything, all your PCs and everything, all your office equipment and et cetera, a big incentive to go ahead and spend it. And that's exactly what they did last year. The animal spirits, to use a Keynesian term here, were released because they expected and got $5 trillion, as we've been saying. And that $5 trillion, of course, some of it was implemented because people aren't aware. Those tax cuts, the Trump tax cuts passed in December signed in January were retroactive to last September. Yeah, they're not going forward, just retroactive. Oh, nice. And of course, they knew it was going to be retroactive all along, and that's why they started spending some of that tax cut money, boosting corporate profits 10 to 31%, the bottom line windfall to their bottom line corporate profits, you know, raise their profits 10 to 31%, depending on the corporation and the industry last year. All right, so that was behind the animal spirits, the anticipation of the big tax cuts and the big subsidy and redirecting some of that for the first time in about 10 years into capital spending, as they call it. Now, capital spending, you got to realize, is composed of two things that are very important to distinguish. One is what they call core capital goods, you know, equipment and so forth. And the other is aircraft orders, Boeing, Lockheed. And the aircraft orders are a very large item, you know, $100 million per F-35 and $1 billion almost for one of these big jumbo jets. So, you know, when they get an order for those, it really boosts the capital spending contribution to GDP. Well, you got to take those aircraft orders out of the number if you really want to see what capital spending is actually doing. And if you take it out for the first quarter of 2018, what you got is a flat capital spending, almost flat growth. Now, figure this. Right, we give them $5 trillion, and we make it retroactive to September. And except for aircraft, which always bounce up and down, we get what? Virtually nothing. They haven't even really begun spending that yet, but they will, you know, probably for the rest of the year. But not inventory spending, which is capital goods. You know, you won't see inventory spending because they overspent that in anticipation of growth this year, which won't be forthcoming. But, you know, you may see some of that capital spending occurring, but it didn't really occur the first quarter here, except for aircraft. Yet we get this guy, economist Hazlitt, who's now heading up Trump's Council of Economics, Economic Council, right? Comes on Bloomberg TV this morning. And, wow, he really exaggerates the capital spending. He says, whoa, you know, it's doing so great, but he doesn't tell you mostly aircraft orders, right? And then we have a problem with consumer spending. Consumer spending now in the first quarter has significantly slowed down, only 1%, 1.1%. So that's not much of a growth in consumer spending in the first quarter. And what's undermining that is what I've been predicting for some time, and that is the effect of the auto sector slowdown and residential construction. I've been predicting that the autos were really primed for a significant slowdown last year, and then we had the hurricanes, and that kind of delayed the effect. Well, the hurricane purchasing of autos is over. And what we got now is the slowdown beginning to take effect. In the first quarter GDP of this 2.3%, the auto effect was a negative 0.4. Okay, so if autos had not slowed down, auto sales, GDP would have been 2.7, but they did slow down significantly. And the same with residential construction. I predicted that with the interest rates rising, you're going to see a slowdown in that. And actually, we do see a 0.1 negative 0.1 drop from a year earlier in residential housing construction. So autos and housing are beginning to feel the pain from rising interest rates. And they're talking about two and three more maybe hikes by the Federal Reserve and the interest rates. Well, that's going to really slow things down significantly in those two sectors, those two important sectors. Okay. And consider this. Now we got rising oil prices as, of course, healthcare continues to rise. Premiums are double digit. Premiums are increasing double digit again in healthcare. And we have housing and rent inflation continuing. So oil prices and those services will certainly have an impact on spending on the services side. We're going to see that take a hit here in the rest of 2018. And of course, autos and residential construction will continue to weaken because of the rate hikes going on. So consumer spending, which was only 1% here growth in the first quarter, is going to weaken even more. And consumer spending, of course, is 70% of GDP. So all this talk by Hazlitt and all the other happy faces of the Trump administration, all the spin, all the facts, there's lies and there's manipulation of facts. And we say, well, Trump plays fast and loose with the facts. Well, these economists and politicians have been doing that for years in their own sophisticated way. And that's, of course, what's happening here. We've got a problem with consumption going forward, consumer spending in this country for the rest of the year. And that will totally upend all this happy talk about, oh, we're going to have 3-4% annual growth rate in 2018. After we come in with 2.3, that means you're going to have to grow a couple quarters at 4% in order to get a net for the whole year 2018 of 3% or more. No way, no way with consumer spending going to weaken for these reasons I mentioned, are you going to get a 4% GDP growth rate going forward? Especially if capital spending, minus aircraft, of course, it also continues to stagnate. It's going to be interesting. If core capital spending is essentially flat first quarter after a $5 trillion tax cut, you could argue that, well, maybe it's going to be a delayed effect, but you could argue that maybe there'll be no effect from the Trump tax cut on capital spending. And I think there's at least 50-50 chance that that's going to be the case as well. Why? Because look, the cost of capital for businesses was almost zero going into this tax cut. Why would we give a record tax cut, $5 trillion, if it didn't cost anything to expand capital spending and business weren't? I mean, you would argue logically that, okay, let's give a business tax cut if the cost of capital were rising significantly, but it was flat and we passed this tax cut, which means it was just a subsidy, just a windfall subsidy for businesses. And some of them probably knew damn well that it wasn't going to produce much increase in capital spending. Well, okay, but then we have maybe the argument that there's a lag here. Well, we'll see. We'll see whether capital spending bounces back in the rest of 2018, because it's pretty damn flat here for the first quarter, except for aircraft. But yet, if you listen to Hazlitt and others, well, they pump up, here it comes, it was justified, right? The tax cut was justified. Look at capital spending. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Okay. And of course, we have the other possibility too, that will have a further negative effect from net exports on US GDP for the rest of the year. Because I'm not sure if we're back on. I understand we had an internet crash here.
We're back.
We're back.
Okay, good to know. All right, so maybe they'll edit it out. I don't know. Apologies to the listeners. The internet, we have no control over it. And apparently it crashed. We record this by Skype. So that's our problem. Well, let me just sum up then. I don't know where I lost the connection here. So let me just sum up. I was looking, talking about GDP, US GDP first quarter, and beginning to sum up my comments on that. And just to repeat the summary once again, US GDP release first quarter of 2.3%, right? Really 2%. Because of the definitional changes several years ago, being pumped up by Hazlitt and other administration spokespersons here, exaggerating the capital spending contribution to GDP, which has been all aircraft, volatile aircraft, commercial aircraft numbers, which typically happens. And if you look at the real core capital spending, pretty flat, right? And pretty flat, despite the $5 trillion in tax cuts here for businesses, retroactive to last September. And then you look at consumer spending, which is 70% of GDP, and what you see is a pretty weak number of 1.1% for the first quarter. And that is due was due to the auto industry now turning down finally after the hurricanes and residential construction. Slowing down because of rising interest rates, and autos also because of rising interest rates. And those rates are going to continue of at the rate of two or three more Fed rate hikes per year. And the Fed rate hikes are occurring even though the core inflation PCE is only 1.5%. No justification for those rate hikes, except they have to raise the rates to pay for the huge deficit. And that's why the rates are going up. And going forward, the auto effect, the inflation effect, the rate effect are going to continue impacting consumer spending. And we're probably going to see a continued negative effect on the net exports or trade deficit on GDP as well. So if you look at business spending, questionable and softer than reported, consumer spending quite soft and quite possibly even softer. Trade, not a great contribution going forward, which leaves just government spending, which is the defense spending primarily. Okay, that's the picture of US GDP. And as I said in past shows and continue to say here, what we're going to see is a recession in 2019 or 20 at the latest. And by the way, that will be the third, second at least, dip in GDP after the 2008-9 crash. If you look at US GDP numbers in third and fourth quarter 2012, they were flat. And that justifies a double dip. You know, two quarters in a row, they were flat, virtually zero. Of course, they've been adjusted upwards because of the redefinition after 2013 to GDP. But if you use the old numbers before the change in the definitions, it was a flat economy, no growth for 6 months. And that kind of corresponded to Europe, which went into a deep double dip in 2012. And then we had the US economy that kind of stalled, not as badly, but stalled in 2015 as well. In response to a crisis in China and global economic slowdown in 15. You know, in my 2010 book, I predicted what I called an epic recession. An epic recession, not to be confused with a great recession, an epic recession is one where you have a deep contraction brought on by a financial a crash. And the recovery is very slow, uneven, characterized by very low growth periods for a while, and then contractions, short and shallow growth followed by repeated short and shallow contractions. So it's kind of like a long-term stagnation, with a little growth followed by no growth, negative growth, little growth, negative growth. That's actually what happened in 1907-8. We had a financial crash, a big one, and followed by an what I call epic recession of the short, shallow recoveries up until 1914 and the war, World War I. Well, I predicted back in 2010, that's in my book, Epic Recession, That's exactly what we would have, and we did have it. We had a very, very subpar growth recovery after 2009-10. That is really much like an epic recession. As I said, we had a double dip in 2012 and a stall in 2015, and that's characteristic of an epic recession. Okay. And the question is now, what's going to happen in 19 and 20? Certainly 19. Well, are we going to have another stall, or will it be, an actual contraction of sorts? We'll have to see, but certainly a stalling and quite possibly another contraction, which would be the third dip, since 2008. So we may be stuck in a long run, chronic epic recession scenario here in the US, and that's highly likely. On the other hand, if we have another financial crash, that will certainly mean the whole process will be even a more severe contraction, more like 2008-9. And that will, of course, mean we'll have even more chronic stagnation following that. Okay. That's my take on GDP, US GDP, and where we are today. Well, let's look at what this means for the global economy. Well, with this weak performance for the US GDP and the scenario that it may continue for the rest of the year, we contrast that with what's happening in Europe. Well, we released numbers on the UK GDP here today, and guess what? A growth rate of 0.1%. In other words, it's flattened. It's totally collapsed to a stagnant growth rate in the UK. The whole bottom fell out. Now, what that means is that the UK, the Bank of England, will not raise rates, interest rates, right? Even though the US is raising interest rates, the UK will not. Now, what that means is that the gap between British bonds at British rates and US interest rates and bonds will continue to spread, will widen. And that will mean that investors in the UK will move their money from the UK to the US, right? Now, when they move their money to the UK to the US, that will have an effect on bonds. Bond demand and bond prices in the US. So the UK is in a deep funk. And it's interesting to watch the impact of all of this on their Brexit plans. Over 2 years ago, they said, we're going to leave. We're going to leave the EU, right? Brexit plans. And I predicted the longer they delayed that, the less likely it would happen. And, Prime Minister May is being outmaneuvered, and the Conservatives are being outmaneuvered. The whole idea was to delay, prevent, and provide obstacles to actually implementing Brexit so that the economy would deteriorate, and then they'll have another vote and it'll change it, and they won't exit the EU. That's the strategy, you see. And so far, it seems to be working for those who don't want to exit. The EU. Okay, so UK basket case, economic basket case. And we're seeing something similar happening in the rest of Europe. It too is slowing down. German industrial production actually turned negative for the first time in a long time here in most recent data. And of course, as Germany goes, Europe goes. And what that portends is that there's a slowdown going on or emerging as well in Europe. So much for the synchronized global growth rate predictions and forecasts and hype, right? It's gone. It's already gone. There is no synchronized growth, right? That was all hype. Same thing's going to happen in Europe. That's happening in the UK, and that is the central bank now will not raise interest rates. They're being very cautious about talking around the fact, as was, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank in Frankfurt, saying the same thing. Oh, we're going to raise rates, do something about this huge QE, quantitative easing, freebie that we're giving our banks and financial institutions. We're going to do something about that and stop that, just as the U.S. Fed a couple of years ago said, okay, we're not going to buy bonds the way we were, which is just a subsidy, a windfall for the banks. We're not going to buy the bonds. Well, the others had to follow suit. But their economies are so weak in England and in the ECB that now they're saying, well, maybe we should just continue with these bond buying. And what's going to happen in Europe is they're going to run out of government bonds to buy, and even corporate bonds. If you look at the ECB, what are they buying? They're buying mostly German and French and Northern European bonds instead of the bonds of the periphery, which really needs to, have the demand and the purchases to lower their rates. But the ECB is buying the bonds of the countries that least need it, both corporate and government bonds, right? But what's going to happen to Europe soon is that what's happening to Japan and the Bank of Japan, and that is they're running out of bonds to buy. They've bought them all up, almost. There's very few. They've bought them up. So Bank of Japan is in a funk now. Bank of Japan, of course, as they bought up all the bonds, now turns to buying up stocks. So they're subsidizing the stock markets as well as bond markets in Japan. And that's cutting off business investment. They're just selling bonds to businesses, government bonds to businesses and so forth. Slowing down the economy in Japan. All this central bank strategy of subsidizing the banks is ending up distorting their economies and long-term slowing down the growth rate in those economies. And that's what we see as the central banks continue doing this. They're undermining the whole system that they're claiming to stabilize. It's a contradiction of the first order. So you won't see the ECB now and Mario Draghi raising interest rates. And you won't see Carney, the head of the Bank of England Central Bank, raising interest rates. At the same time, the U.S. Fed is raising interest rates rapidly. Now, one of the effects of the U.S. raising interest rates so fast is finally now an impact on emerging markets. Well, how does that work? Well, when the U.S. raises interest rates, it increases the demand for U.S. dollars, because if investors offshore want to invest in treasury bonds or whatever, they've got to buy dollars with their own currencies. Well, if they buy dollars with their own currencies, that drives up the price of the dollar. So rising interest rates in the U.S. result in rising global values of the dollar relationship to other currencies. Now, what that means for emerging markets like in Latin America is as the dollar rises in value, their currencies decline in value, because exchange rates are always, country to country. What it means for emerging markets is that if the value of their currency is declining, then the value of the investment holdings in those countries is also falling. And if it's falling, why do you want to keep your investments in a currency that is declining? You're losing money. So what happens is investors take their money out of the investments in their domestic economy in Argentina or Chile or Brazil. They take their money out, their pesos, whatever, reals, and they use it to buy dollars, driving up the price of dollars to invest in government bonds that are interest rates that are high, you see. So the rising interest rates in the U.S. mean rising dollar and it means declining currency values and other currencies, and then a selling of those assets in those currencies to go and buy dollars to invest in U.S. bonds. What I just described is capital flight. You know, if you're selling your assets and your investments in Argentina because your currency is falling, you're sending that money out of the country, and you're sending it to international currency markets to buy dollars, and it's gone. Once you buy the dollars, it's gone. Well, in order to stifle or slow that capital flight, what central banks and emerging markets do is raise their interest rates, right, to keep up with rising U.S. interest rates, to discourage conversion of currencies and discourage capital flight. Well, what happens when you raise your domestic interest rates? You slow down your domestic economy, don't you? And that's exactly what's happening now, beginning to happen in Latin America, for example. And that's why Argentina's central bank and other central banks are in South America are raising their interest rates. It's going to slow down their economy. It's going to result in recessions in those economies. That's coming. That's a consequence of U.S. rate hikes and dollar valuation increases, recessions in emerging markets. And that's what's going to happen right now. And if their currency flows out, we have another problem there in emerging markets, and that is, how do they pay for all the debt they've incurred since 2008? Emerging market economies have added maybe $25 trillion in debt. How are they going to pay for that? And if they can't pay for that, there's going to be defaults and financial crises in emerging markets. You see, all these things are connected because it's a global capitalist economy, and you can no longer talk about this economy or that economy. They're all part of one economy now, especially on the financial side. And what the U.S. does as the dominant economy has an impact, repercussions on all these other economies, from Europe and England to, you know, Argentina, all over Japan, and that crisis is beginning to emerge as well. The U.S., as it attempts the growth, is doing so at the expense of other economies around the world. Well, isn't that Trump's America First plan? Yeah, that's what that's all about, and that's why the globalists, the traditional elites in the U.S., are really having a heartburn over all of Trump's policies here, because they know America First means wreck the rest, you see, because of all the interconnections, which means that America can't grow unless it's at the expense of other countries, and vice versa. The other countries can't grow unless it's at the expense of growth and jobs and development in the U.S., and that's a great contradiction. And what we get is Trump coming around, you know, in 2016, shifting that whole scenario where the U.S. was globalizing. And as a result of that, the rest of the world economy was doing better. But America, and particularly its workforce, was doing much worse. You know, free trade treaties, offshoring, all that. And finally, people were beginning to get upset about globalization, free trade, and all that. And Trump, tapped into that. He was the only guy that tapped into that because he didn't owe anything to the traditional elites, you know, like Hillary did and all the rest of them, Obama, George W., right? They're all part of that traditional elite. And they liked the arrangement where America grew less at a cost of everyone else growing more, because they were making more of their profits offshore than they were onshore. See, they were for globalization because they were benefiting from it. But American workers weren't benefiting from it. And Trump tapped into that, right? Now, is he going to deliver on it is the next question. And that's what this trade war, so-called, is all about. Is he going to deliver on it? I don't think so. I have a long piece coming out in the World Review of Political Economy, a written article called the U.S. Deja Vu China Trade War. I'll put the excerpts up on my blog, jackrasmus.com, so take a look at that over the weekend. And then, of course, I'll provide the reference to the rest of the article once it appears. But it's a comprehensive article. It's a long article, 7,000 words, that really says there's a dual-track trade policy under Trump. There's a phony trade war, and there's an emerging trade war with China. Emerging, because it's not a war yet, you see. This week coming up, all the key U.S. negotiators are rushing off to Beijing to have the real negotiations now. You see, both sides have thrown down the gauntlet in the real trade war, China-U.S. The U.S. has slapped $50 billion of tariffs that aren't taking effect yet. They won't until late May at the earliest. And the Chinese have slapped another $50 billion that haven't taken effect yet against us. It's a tit-for-tat, quid pro quo kind of a thing, you know. But they've defined where they're kind of going, but they haven't gone yet. They're still going to negotiate this. And as I say in this article, what the U.S. wants is threefold from China. First of all, technology transfer. Technology transfer, particularly the new technologies, which are artificial intelligence, 5G wireless, and cybersecurity. These are the technologies of the industries of the future. And China is betting heavy on them. China released this position strategic report called China 2025 last year. It's analogous to China's One Belt, One Road infrastructure strategy. Well, China 2025 is their technology strategy. And where they're going are in these three key areas, 5G, cybersecurity, and AI. And they want to be the leader in that. They're filing as many patents as the U.S. now, and the rest of the world's behind. You know, it's a two-country race for patents, and it has to do with all these new technologies. Well, you know, as a consequence of this policy, China is implementing it by requiring U.S. corporations in China or wanting to go in China to share this technology with them. And U.S. corporations, in their avarice objectives, you know, they just want to make money, and they see a trillion or a billion plus population economy and all the money they could make in China, so they want to get in China, make far more money there than they will in the U.S. In fact, the auto companies now are making more money in China than they are in the U.S., right? And they don't care about what country, you know, they just want to make money. So China is extracting technology as a condition of doing business in China. And also China has recently embarked upon trying to acquire U.S. companies that have some technology. But the U.S. Senate and Congress and the defense establishment in particular say, oh, no, no, you can't do this anymore. And the latest in this was the ZTE Corp, right? Last week, a big flap over the ZTE Corp making acquisitions in the U.S., Chinese company, right? And the U.S. Blocking them, saying they can't do that. By the way, if you want to listen to a debate, well, hardly a debate, discussion between myself and another British academic who has written a book on China trade, our interview, joint interview on Loud and Clear Radio, half an hour interview. Also go to my blog, jackrasmus.com. It's posted there. You can listen to that about, you know, ZTE and how that plays out here in this emerging trade war with China, right? Trump has recently also blocked a Chinese funded finance company called Broadcom from purchasing Qualcomm, U.S. chip company in San Diego, big in the whole 5G area. Part of the trade war is not just, we got 50 billion tariff, you got 50 billion tariff. No, it's you can't acquire this company, we'll block that, and you can't invest in that company, we'll block that. Those individual company tactics are going on as well. ZTE, Qualcomm, et cetera, and they will continue as long as the U.S. and China continue to maneuver. So the big negotiations are going to really start next week in private, in quiet. Both China and the U.S. threw out their big warnings with their 50 billion, and Trump said, "Oh, we're going to slap another 100 billion if we have to." And then Chinese said, "Well, we'll have another 100 billion too." All right? So it's a quid pro quo going on there, but it's all talk, you see. That's all words and bombast, typical Trump bombast. Right, and then the real negotiations are going on behind the scenes. Now, what the U.S. wants? Well, technology transfer at the front of that, and then it also wants more access to China markets by U.S. corporations, minus technology transfer. Both auto companies, auto access in China. And banks in particular want to get deeper into China and get a piece of the action there. Well, China has thrown a carrot saying already that U.S. corporations can have 51% interest. They can control company they might acquire in China. And that in the next 3 years, China said we'll move this to 100%. So China's throwing a carrot. Yeah, you can have more access to our markets. Okay, but China's not throwing a carrot on technology transfer, you see. And then the third objective is some sort of evidence that the trade deficit volume magnitude will be reduced to some extent. That's another thing, because that's what Trump will be able to sell to his political base. See, I made the Chinese back off, right? And now they're going to buy more from us than we're going to buy from them, All he needs is some sort of token thing that he's going to blow up and exaggerate and go around to his base in Indiana and who knows where and say, "Look what I did, look what I did," right? In anticipation, mobilizes his base in anticipation of the elections coming up in November 18, and as a way of mobilizing his base, so that if they come, Mueller comes after him and so forth, he can threaten that his base is gonna, he's gonna agitate his base even more as a counterpoint, you say, to the traditional elites. So there's domestic politics, heavy, heavy, behind this trade thing with China. And it's America First strategy being resurrected by Trump, because that was a big thing he got elected on, maybe the most important thing that won him those states in the Midwest to give him the Electoral College, narrow victory he did. He got into office. Well, that worked for him in 16, and now he's playing the same card in 18, 2018. He's agitating that base on America First, and what's better than America First than trade? See? So there's domestic politics. That's what Trump wants. He wants some kind of visible win that he can hype and exaggerate to his base. What the U.S. defense establishment really wants, the CIA, Pentagon, and so forth, is some slowdown on this technology transfer, because it's not just business, it's national defense. These technologies are the key to the next generation weapons. And the U.S. is worried that China's going to catch up and leapfrog them in weapons development. And that's why they want to slow it down. All right. So the defense lobby is behind wanting technology transfer slowed. Big multinational corporations and banks are behind wanting more access to the Chinese market. And Trump is behind, oh, I want some evidence that I can tout to my base that I've done something about the trade deficit, and then argue the jobs will be coming back as a result, which they won't. But that's what he wants to say. And you've got a three-way split going on within the elites, the capitalists in this country, over trade policy, and that just expressed it, you see. That three-way lobby within it, and if you look at who Trump sent over to talk to Beijing next week, you got this guy Lighthizer and Peter Navarro, who are hardliners on technology transfer, and lined up there with the defense establishment and the war industries. You got Steve Mnuchin, the banker, treasury guy, right, who's lined up with U.S. multinational corporations, and then you got Kudlow. Who is the, economic advisor there to Trump, who is representing his interests? Okay, you got all elements of the three groups, three lobbies, internal lobbies there, expressing the U.S. Trade position. And we'll see which one prevails. Maybe a little bit of each, because all Trump wants is to be able to show something. And that's why I predict there will be an agreement between China and the US on all of this. It will be an agreement eventually. Now, will it come before November 18th? I don't know. Trump may want to just drag it out and look tough, talk tough before November 18th and then conclude something. Or he may feel he needs to conclude something before November 18th. So, that's a tactical move, and it's not clear what he's going to do. But he will do something. There will be no true trade war with China, is what I'm saying. Just as there's no real true trade war with the rest of the world. That's the phony trade war, you see? That's the other side of the trade war. All U.S. allies, that was what the tariffs on steel and aluminum were all about, to get everyone's attention there and saying, you better renegotiate something with us. We want some token change. And of course, he got his token change in revising the bilateral free trade agreement with South Korea. Right? South Korea can permanently import steel to the U.S. Right? They not only were not cutting, forced to cut back on their imports. Now they got a permanent right to import steel in the U.S., and they're the third largest importer of steel to the U.S. Trump said that's okay. And what did he get? He got some token agreement on selling cars in the U.S. cars in Korea, and some token agreement on quotas on Korea selling trucks in the U.S., so benefiting the auto industry. Right, not the steel industry. That was a deal benefiting the auto industry. Right, and the same thing's going on with NAFTA. A big headline today about oh, Trump thinks NAFTA's going fine, right? And what is fine? Oh, it's just some token agreement, on auto parts and so forth. Some token thing will come out of a tweaking of the NAFTA agreement. It's not being torn up as he promised in his hyperbole during election, right? He says NAFTA is moving along nicely, right? The Mexicans have an election coming up very soon, he says, but we're doing very nicely with NAFTA. I could make a deal really quickly. But we'll see what happens. That's a quote from Trump, right? Just last week, a few days ago, right? He's going to get his token adjustment to the NAFTA rules, which is all he really ever wanted, you see. And he's going to use that, he's going to hype it and exaggerate it and lie about it and go back and give speeches and so forth, say, see what I did? I really stuck it to these Mexicans and Canadians, right? Well, NAFTA, big deal. It'll be all phony. That's the phony trade war. You see, the other trade war is the phony trade war. Phony with South Korea, phony with NAFTA, and it's going to be phony with Europe. You think this guy Macron, president of France, is over here talking just about the China, I mean, not China, the Iran deal? No. No, they're talking about trade, and their economies, number one, right? That's what they're talking about. By the way, on that Iran trade, Iran treaty deal, I'm gonna, step out into some political predictions here, maybe beyond my expertise, but I will predict that Trump will pull out of the Iran deal, but it will be a token pullout because then nothing will change, you see. The U.S. will continue abiding by the terms, although it publicly declares it's pulled out, and part of the agreement for not changing the terms, part of the agreement with Macron in Europe for not changing the terms, will be okay, Europe, you back us up to, let's see if we can get a little more bite at the apple and amend the Iranian deal. So I, Trump, can say, see, I stopped their ballistic missiles. You see, I'll have a story. I think that's what's behind this deal. So it'll be much like the Paris Accords. The U.S. pulls out but doesn't do anything about it, you see, and it waits for an opportunity to renegotiate a little better deal for the U.S. Well, Iran's going to be the same way, right? A little better deal for the U.S. that Trump can then hype and say, oh, look what the big deal I made, right? Same thing. He hypes to his base, the climate change, but he doesn't change that much. And he hypes the Iran deal, it doesn't change that much. He hypes the trade deals with NAFTA, but doesn't change that much. And that's why I believe when he goes and negotiates with his friends, his team there in Beijing, they too will come to a deal. It's all about politics and Trump being able to get a little story that he then pumps up and says, look at what I did to his political base, you see. And it's all phony. The trade war is phony, and all these other deals by Trump are phony. Just to get something to argue to his base. Okay, that's it. Next week, we'll talk about the yield curve. What is the yield curve and why is it an important indicator of the U.S. economic direction?